From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Near Eastridge.
Sunset.
Eastside, San Francisco.
Border of Milpitas.
San Jose.
Coming up, an artist collective responds to San Francisco's shrinking black population.
Many people would look at us like, my gosh, it's a group of black people together in San Francisco, which became like a revolutionary thing.
Then a tribute to a legendary black San Francisco artist from the age of disco.
Everyone has a story of Sylvester. I feel like he's the Beyonce of that generation of San Francisco, you know?
And the thoughts of a young Oakland poet.
My home is more a cave. I'm less human, more primate in this day and age of useless things and waste.
Local expressions from artists close to home. Today on Cross Currents, stay with us. Next Tuesday, San Francisco's Board of Supervisors will vote on a proposal for a new marquee on the historic Fillmore Auditorium in the Western Addition. It would mark the neighborhood as a cultural destination. There's some irony in the timing, though. A longtime Fillmore institution, the St. John Coltrane Church, is facing imminent eviction. After so-called redevelopment programs in the 1950s and 60s decimated the neighborhood's black cultural institutions, there have been efforts to revive the old spirit of the place. But alongside those efforts, San Francisco's black population has been dwindling. In 1990, 11% of city residents were black. Now, it's under 6%. So there's a question. Are black folks leaving San Francisco for the same reasons as everyone else? Or does it go deeper than that? KALW's Todd Whitney gives us a brief look at the history of African Americans in San Francisco.
It's no secret that black folks are leaving San Francisco. The city's hemorrhaging of black people is so bad that a few years back, a supervisor warned that the city's reputation for being diverse is in question if the out-migration continues. But how did we get to this point? The history of black San Francisco starts back in the early 1800s. It was a moment in time when African Americans started coming out pretty much for the same reasons as everyone else. Opportunities, gold, jobs, and freedom. Even so, for a long time, SF's black population was low. So low that there was even a running joke that if you were a black person in San Francisco, you probably already knew all the other black folks living in the city.
The 1940 census said there was less than 5,000 blacks living in San Francisco.
This is from a 1998 San Francisco Public Library interview with Thomas Fleming.
And then when the war began, some 50,000.
The war workers started coming in.
He was the founder of one of the city's black newspapers, the Sun Reporter.
They started coming in right after Pearl Harbor. The war workers did.
December 7th. 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
In 1941, America entered World War II, and the West Coast became the epicenter of the military's war machine. New shipyard jobs became a catalyst for black folks to come to San Francisco from places like Louisiana, Texas, and Arkansas. In San Francisco, new black enclaves exploded as the population ballooned. The Fillmore District was one of them. It became a black neighborhood for the same reason the South Side of Chicago did, Harlem did, or Compton did. Restrictive covenants. These were things written into property titles, and they said things like,
"No person of African, Japanese, Chinese, or of any Mongolian descent shall be allowed to purchase, own, or lease said real property, or any part thereof, or to occupy, except as servants."
So many of the newly arrived black folks from the South ended up in the Fillmore, in houses recently vacated by Japanese Americans who had been relocated to internment camps. The Fillmore became known as the Harlem of the West. Everyone from Count Basie and Etta James to Thelonious Monk and Duke Ellington would kick it in the Fillmore when they were out on the West Coast. But after the war ended, redevelopment projects started to demolish many Fillmore homes and businesses. So a lot of residents relocated to Bayview and Hunters Point. In theory, they could always go back to the Fillmore once the projects ended, but that rarely happened. The Fair Housing Act of 1968 outlawed restrictive covenants, but the damage was already done. By this point, there weren't many incentives for black folks to stick around San Francisco. So many ended up moving out to Oakland, where black middle class was starting to flourish. In San Francisco, among the few black folks left, a few fought for better living and employment standards.
Because we do feel like that we have been an island, all set off on an island by ourselves.
Eloise Westbrook was part of the Big Five, five women activists who demanded more attention from city officials for Bayview and Hunters Point. Here she is giving an interview back in 69.
The people who live in Hunters Point, who have lived there for numerous of years, at one time had lost all hope, all faith. But we do feel like that with the new construction of the new housing, that hope has began to come back up again, hoping that we are going to have better schools, hoping we're going to have better housing, hoping that some jobs will come into that era, that our young men may also feel, have more dignity and pride, that they won't be on welfare or standing on the corners.
Black San Franciscans are still fighting for many of the same things as Eloise Westbrook. Housing is tight and incomes are low. And now the city is standing on a precipice. If trends continue, San Francisco's black population is going to end up looking more like Salt Lake City's rather than New York or LA. In San Francisco, I'm Todd Whitney for Cross Currents.
San Francisco is losing its African-American population. Hovering around 6% now, research suggests that by 2020, that number will drop to just under 4%. The 3.9 Collective is a group of black artists who take that name from the 2020 projected percentage of black San Franciscans. Let's hear from them now.
My name is Michael Ross. I live here in San Francisco. I'm an artist. I do mostly two-dimensional work, mostly painting and drawing on paper.
William Rote, visual artist, mixed media, sculpture, and some two-dimensional work.
Nancy Cato, cartoon illustrator.
3.9 Art Collective is a collective of African-American artists in the city of San Francisco.
It has become a collective of all disciplines.
Wood, glass, metal, cardboard, you know, you name it, whatever I find.
Collage.
Pen and ink.
Color pencil. Fabric and acrylic paint.
It formed really, it was amazing, out of a conversation.
Conversation William and I had about black artists not being visible.
One member turned into two members turned into three members, and then we started to grow.
Often, just the nature of being a visual artist will have you isolated in some ways from others. There was questions about, are there black artists in San Francisco?
It's been a place where you can just talk to one another about what's going on. Being able to go to people who have perhaps been through it already as black artists.
Just the idea of being able to speak with, connect with, and talk to peers.
Sadly enough, we have 25 members. We've already lost 4 members due to being pushed out of the city because of high rent prices and having their rent control taken away from them. I hope we can inspire people in general, regardless of your ethnicity. But I really hope we can inspire African-Americans. What I've experienced in San Francisco is there is so much fear, and the focus is to assimilate. And people believe, particularly a lot of young black people or brown or people of color, they believe that their only successes come from complete assimilation, which means I have to throw away what I have. My culture, my value, my worth, in order to assimilate into what I believe is a greater culture, which many times is the Caucasian culture. Us coming together as a collective really became a stand because many people would look at us like, my gosh, it's a group of black people together in San Francisco, which became like a revolutionary thing. Hey.
Those were the voices of Michael Ross, Nancy Cato, and William Rhodes, members of the 3.9 Collective, a group of Black artists in San Francisco. That piece was produced by KLW's Todd Whitney. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. African-American disco legend Sylvester wasn't born in San Francisco, but he came into his own as an artist in the city in the 1970s. He was a trailblazer both musically and culturally, with his high, clear falsetto and unapologetic presence as a fabulous gay Black artist. He became known as the Queen of Disco. The story of his life and music are now being brought to the stage in Mighty Real, a fabulous Sylvester musical, currently running at the Brava Theater in San Francisco. Co-creators Anthony Wayne and Kendrell Bowman came by the studio and spoke to KLW's Jen Chien about sequins, platform heels, and the resilient spirit of the man behind the disco ball.
So for me, I grew up in San Francisco, and I've been around gay culture almost all my life, and so I feel like I have to love Sylvester. Mm-hmm. What about for you? What does Sylvester mean to you, and how did you find out about him? Let's start with you, Anthony.
Well, Sylvester was the quintessential pioneer. He went against the grain to be who he was regardless of any situation, and there was a documentary on TV1, Unsung. They did a special about his life, and I saw it, and I was like, wow, this man's drive to be who he was, wanted to be regardless of any situation, was incredible. And it inspired me to say, you know what, I think everybody needs to hear this story.
Kendrell, what does Sylvester mean to you?
Sylvester, he was a visionary, and he's a trailblazer long before you have people like RuPaul, Adam Lambert, that's out now. But back then in the 70s, you have this 6 foot tall African American that's riding around San Francisco in mopeds and fur, with a long fur and makeup on.
Just being himself
and living in his truth. And that's the big thing for me. Anyone that's living in their truth and not afraid to just be themselves, I respect. And at that time, I know it was harder than, you know, it is now.
There weren't really role models for him. He was his own role model.
He just woke up and said, this is it, accept it or reject it.
Yeah, yeah. He wanted the world to mold to him rather than the other way around.
Exactly. Uh-huh. And it takes a lot of strength to do that. And the great thing is, you know, Sylvester's story is not just a story for disco or in the 70s back then. It's a universal story, not just for African Americans, but just for anyone who wants to strive to be whatever they want to be. And that's what I think with even our show that we made, that a lot of people identify with, all age range and demographics. Everyone just wants to be true to themselves. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Everybody wants to be seen, loved, and heard. That's what I say. And he was definitely that.
Well, of course, San Francisco, Sylvester has a special place in the heart of San Franciscans. What kind of response did the audience give you here as opposed to New York or anywhere else that you may have performed? Is there a difference performing kind of where he was?
Well, absolutely.
Or for you?
Yes. I mean, even before the show started, you could just hear that everybody was ready. And I think the thing about it, they're ready to be taken on the journey. You know, I think a lot of people know of Sylvester and knew him personally. To bring people back to that time, you know, to connect with San Francisco audiences, I think it really has a strong bond.
Have you noticed, Kendrell, anything special about how the show plays here in San Francisco?
It's not only in the theater, it's even walking down the street. We have these Sylvester jackets. And oh my Lord, we can't even walk to the corner to go get like a donut or something. Everyone has a story of Sylvester. I feel like he's the Beyonce of that generation of San Francisco, you know? Everyone has a story, everyone knew him. And the great thing about performing here in San Francisco, it's like, you know, we were performing for his family and friends. The audience here is amazing. They come in all, you know, their sequins and their boas and their fans.
Right, fans.
And, you know, so it's like a disco party. This is not a stereotypical theater setting show how we made it. We made you, right when you come into the door, you feel like you've been transported into a disco club.
As you spoke of, the part of the conceit of the show is that we're in a club and that it's one last concert where Sylvester can be mighty real one more time and share his music and story with the audience. Now, Anthony, you start the show with a kind of conjuring of Sylvester's spirit, like an incantation almost of bringing him to the audience. What do you do for yourself to bring Sylvester through you or to get into that character?
I listen to his music. I have to get kind of quiet before, but then I start to warm up, of course.
You mean vocally?
Vocally, yes. I have moments where I go around to the cast and I speak to everybody and I kind of just, you know, feel their energy and like they feed me kind of in that way. I'll listen to the overture and I'll hear it starting.
Now, when you say overture, I think of, you know, kind of strings or orchestra, but it's a disco overture,
right?
It's
a whole disco overture. But and you hear the song, you hear the music, and you just kind of get into the world. And then Sylvester speaks before he comes out. And, you know, I just start to feel everybody's energy from the audience. And I just try to do what I can to bring the essence of who he is through me.
I'm speaking with Anthony Wayne and Kendrell Bowman, co-creators of Mighty Real, a fabulous Sylvester musical. How is performing this role different from other types of musical theater roles?
I'm used to being in the ensemble. And so now being in the front, it's like, you know, much more responsibility, much more time and much more pressure, you know, especially singing and acting at the same time for such a long time, because Sylvester doesn't really leave the stage for about an hour and a half. But it's different than any other show, because I've done some roles before, like Richie in A Chorus Line. But this one is much more impactful because of the meaning that it has to people. You know, you're portraying someone real. And so you have to really be honest. And I think that's what I consistently find myself working on. I've been so many
places. We spoke earlier about this being your first show that you've put together on your own. For both of you, was that scary? Did you have doubts about stepping out to make this thing?
No, I didn't have any doubts. I don't know what to say. I don't want to lie, but I had doubts when it comes to producing a show. That's a whole different beast. You know, we're producing shows. It costs a lot of money to do these things. And we had the support of the community and Sylvester's fans and, you know, his family. But we took our time. It's not like we just threw this together. It was a lot of research of speaking to his friends, his family, reading articles, everything from the costume designing, everything in the show. We tried to recreate to keep to the truth to Sylvester. It's not like we're making up just what we thought of it. We're using stories from his family that no one's been heard of before. We're using all of his music in the show. So we don't want anyone to be like, that's not what happened. You know what I mean?
Right. Well, Kendrell did the costumes for the show as well.
Yeah,
and
they're
so
beautiful.
He stays very, very true to what it looked like. We were even able to go to the archive.
Here in San Francisco.
The archive here and see the actual costumes. So some of the costumes that he made were replicas of, you know, silhouettes of what he actually wore, which was really kind of cool. So we really bring that forward.
Let's talk a little bit about the costumes. Do you have a favorite, Kendrell, of the costumes that you designed for this show?
What's the favorite? Everyone loves the fur in the beginning. It's a long, fabulous, long fur cape. And, you know, I like on the posters that you see the white tuxedo because, you know, it's very clean, but, you know, it has a pop of color with the flower, and then also he has these big red heels on. When you come to the show, you'll see a lot of sequins, a lot of fur.
So Sylvester was out and proud when racism and homophobia were at an even higher pitch than they are now. How does your own identity as a gay black man affect how you see yourself as an artist?
Well, for me, this is Kendrell. I identify a lot with Sylvester because I feel like he didn't like to be put into a box, and I'm the same way. I try to just live my life for me, and I don't feel like I have to dress a certain way or hang around in some type of crowds or political places, when you get caught up in all of this political stuff and feeling like you have to be some type of way, you may become successful at some point, but then you start to lose your identity of yourself, and it's hard to just be happy.
I definitely agree with what he says. I feel like being a young African-American man in this day and age, you have to have a strong sense of individuality. Paying attention to Sylvester's story, it inspired me because I feel it's all an individual journey of you understanding yourself. And I think we're all in that journey and finding the strength and knowing that the choices that you make as a person is enough.
That was Kendrell Bowman and Anthony Wayne, co-creators of Mighty Real, a fabulous Sylvester musical running at the Brava Theater in San Francisco through March 13th. They spoke with KLW's Jen Sheehan. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. This next artist has his whole career ahead of him. Kyle Lamberson comes from Remix Your Life, a program run by Youth Radio. We've been featuring poems from their students all week. This one is about adapting to the human-made environment. Ready? Give it up for Kyle.
People morph through buildings, their coffee warm in early mornings, swarming, frantic and anxious, like a queen ant observing larva metamorphosis forming. We are Mother Earth's children. She has burned us, made us go to war for her resources, for its fortune, and it has formed us. To nature's war we do not forfeit. Some call women whores and say her virtue is her quietness, but girl, you are more, a princess, even lioness. Disregard the disrespect, stick to pride and roar. Like what I heard a night before on my front porch, a mountain lion's cry. For her home is ever more or less hers. I doubt a soul heard the howl amidst the loudness of the night. I have learned to say what others may disdain, and when I walk into the pavement, all steps I take are out of place. My home is more a cave, I'm less human, more primate in this day and age of useless things and waste. Select few eyes are watching me. I sense the warming patience, like a feline basking in the light of day, observing. The alien airplane soaring across the blue. Never again will I read off dead trees to see what's new. When man does not exist and his pyramids collapse, it will not be a disaster, for we will have paid Mother Nature our dues.
That's poet Kyle Lamberson, a participant with the Remix Your Life Arts Program at Youth Radio. We love to collaborate with our friends at Youth Radio, and we'd love to collaborate with you. Give us a call and tell us your story at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106, and leave us a message. It's because of you that we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio. This music is by Painted Palms. They play this Friday at the Rickshaw Stop in San Francisco. The music starts at 9 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba. See you outside.